This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT Knoxville. 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and I'm your host, Matt Schaefer-Powell. Charlie Mouldin knows a little bit about man's inhumanity to man. In 1968, Mouldin was shot because of the color of his skin. Mouldin is African-American, and he was gunned down while fishing with three friends in a remote corner of Monroe County. The unprovoked attack on Mouldin was just the beginning. Months later, he watched helplessly as the man charged with shooting him walked free. Even now, he carries fragments of that bullet in his leg. We know Charlie Mouldin's story because of the hard work of Knoxville News Sentinel columnist Sam Venable. After poring over hours of recorded testimony, digging through the archives, and interviewing countless witnesses and participants, Venable brought Mouldin's story to the front page earlier this year, 46 years after the bullet first entered Mouldin's right leg. Both men are here with us today, and I want to thank both of you for joining us for Dialogue.
Thank you. Yeah. Happy to be here.
Glad to be here.
Charlie, let's start with you. Tell me about 24-year-old Charlie Mouldin. You were 24 when you were shot. What were you like at the time? How would you describe that young man to somebody?
I was an accomplished brick mason at the time, and it just seemed like I just worked all the time. I was after school, so I didn't fulfill my dream of getting a chance to go to college or play pro ball, whatever.
You played football in high school, yeah.
Yes, and I was at the time working out in the afternoons and weekends. And I had a tryout for the Kansas City Chief that coming Saturday. But the Wednesday before that, some of my friends were getting ready to go fishing, and I asked them where were they going. I thought they was going to the Lake Douglas, somewhere like that, Cherokee.
Hey, we should mention you're from Sevier County.
From Sevier County, yes.
And these were friends of yours from Sevier County.
Right. And people that I worked with and some that I knew, that I knew of through other people. Anyway, they was going fishing. I asked them, where were they going? And they said, what's the name of the stream, Sam?
It's Tellico River.
Yeah, Tellico River. And I said, where in the world is that at? They tried to tell
it's
me.
It's not in Sevier County.
somewhere south of Maryville. So I should have known then. But anyway, I said, have you got room for another person? Said, yeah, come on.
But now, were you a fisherman? I mean, did you do a lot of fishing at the time?
Yeah, I loved fish.
You'd never been trout fishing before?
I'd never been trout fishing in my life.
Okay.
Never had. So I asked him about it, and I'd heard about it and seen trout, but I'd never fished for them. So they told me you had to get a stamp and all of this, and I actually went and bought a new pole, 7-foot Garcia pole, like it was, and a Mitchell 300. Real. And
so you were ready to go?
Oh, yeah. I bought all the sort of fish and bait and everything. Then they told me, oh, we're going to be fishing with corn. I said, corn?
Corn.
Yeah. And I said, just take a kernel of corn, you know. And I thought, well, I'm thinking I'm a farm boy. I thought I had to go get a ear of corn out of the barn, you know. And they said, oh, we got a can of corn, you know.
You can buy it at the store.
Anyway, we got together, and I left with them early that morning. I volunteered to ride in the back of the pickup truck with his son.
And I want to interrupt just for a second. Yeah. It's not necessarily important to the story right now, but it will be important to the story at some point to point out that they're white.
Right.
You're African-American, they're white.
They're white.
The three guys that are with you. Yeah.
There's three of them. Arvie Lee Parton was the man that I was going with. He was a father to...
Leroy.
Leroy. That's excused now.
That was 46 years ago.
Yeah, and I'm a little nervous, too, so pardon me. Then another fellow named Bill Williams. I met Bill Williams through S&H Burden's house moving deal. They did a lot of moving houses, barns, and things like that, and I helped them on one job out on 66 moving a barn just about where the old knife place is now.
Let me ask you real quickly, because as we're talking about you, and again, the race part of it hasn't entered the story yet. But when you were 24 years old, you said you were working a lot. You're trying to get an opportunity to play pro ball. There was a lot going on in 1968 in terms of racial tension around the country. Were you engaged or not really engaged in what was going on? I mean.
I listened to it, saw it on TV if I was in from work early enough. I never got involved in it because I was always the feeling that, hey, if you don't want me in your place, then good, I take my money somewhere else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have a tremendous amount of friends that I grew up with, and they're all white.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small group of blacks there in Sevier County at the time. So all my friends, like 90% of my friends growing up were all white.
Okay, yeah.
So when this race thing went on, I just couldn't understand why it was so violent mm-hmm. everywhere else, you know. Because I had things pretty easy there in Sevier.
I was going to say, I mean, were you confronted? You were still, you still were confronted with some racism in Sevier County.
Off and on, coming up, more so than when I got in high school, not the high school itself. It was outside of the school.
Mm-hmm. So not the kids you went to school with?
No. Because of them is the only reason why I spent my last year in school at Sevier County High.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They treat me very well, especially the football players.
He had gone to Austin the first 3 years,
right. Mm-hmm.
Bust into Knoxville.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, so you're 24 years old. You're going fishing with your friends, and they
right.
take you out to Tellico River.
Right.
Tell me what happened then. What happened next?
Well, we got there early. I think it opens up at 6:30, and we was too early, so we sort of sat around and had to go into the ranger's office and get a.
This is the first day of trout season too.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
To get a trout stamp, but you know you got to wait till the time for mm-hmm. it open. And then we proceeded. Of course, me, I'm just following them, whatever they do. And the truck stopped, and I got out, and they went off in the direction they wanted to go. And I found me a place and went off. And I think I thought I was hanging rocks there for a while until the fish almost had to come out of the water and jump in my path before I knew that he was on my hook. Anyway, I caught two or three at that point. But then I was sort of catching on to where the fish are located, you know, and more calmer water instead of the swift water.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, you learn too much looking at TV. Then when reality hits and you're out there in the real world and you realize things ain't that way.
Well, at what point did you kind of start to realize that something might be,
well,
might go awry here?
I had changed spots two or three times. And this one particular point, I come out from the banks and Leroy was there and I was walking behind Leroy. And this truck, not truck, but this car coming from the rear. Now, I'm walking on the left-hand side of the road, oncoming traffic, and he's coming down on the right-hand side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept hearing the motor rev. And at the time, I always knew that it was a big thing among a lot of the white people if they can make a loud noise and see how a black boy jumps, and
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
eyes getting bigger than a silver dollar and all that. You know, you heard all that.
Yeah.
But this fellow was revving his motor to scare me, and I kept walking straight, and he actually brushed my right leg with the left front fender of his car. And then I stopped and turned around, and he stopped at the car door, and that's when he started giving me my favorite nickname, the mm-hmm. N-word, and then he proceeded. He wanted to know what I was doing there, so I'm just doing a little fishing. And he said, you know, we don't like yous here. I said, well. And I give very short answers when I'm confronted with stuff like that. So he said, how about, did you read that sign downtown? And I said, no, I didn't. What did it say? And he says, you know, ends read and running. Or don't let the sun catch you here. Or something,
mm-hmm.
something
yeah.
to that effect. And I said, no. I said, well, I was in the back of the truck when we got here, so I didn't see the sign. I said, but, you know, just to be a smart aleck, I said, wouldn't have done me no good because I can't read no hand.
And you were just kind of yeah. playing into him
yeah.
at that point,
and,
messing
you know,
with him a little bit.
And I was dancing the thought around in my head to where I want to just play this off because I smelled a little alcohol coming to his breath, or do I want to just go ahead and punch him?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and you're an athlete. You were an athlete.
I was very stout at the
yeah.
time. And
still
I had boxed
out.
Yeah.
And I had boxed a lot too at the time, so I knew I could take care of myself. But, you know, did I want to go through all this trouble and run the rest of the day of fishing? I just want to let this drunk guy say what he wants to say and go on, which
yeah.
I've done in a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Let him go ahead. So he said what he had to say and proceeded on. So Leroy asked me and said, man, we got to go. I said, go. I said, yeah. I said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going fishing. I said, Leroy, if I laugh every time one of these people call me that name, I'd never get out of my front door
mm-hmm.
because I hear it every day. So let's go fishing. So we did. And I fished.
Were they nervous? I mean, from that point on, were they kind of like...
The rest of them was more nervous than I was.
Yeah.
I'd met this before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not quite this before.
Well, we haven't gotten to that part of the story yet.
later on.
At some point, the story kind of takes a bit of a turn that you hadn't... Exactly, yeah.
And I think we ate lunch, whatever, but this is 6:37. Well, I imagine this guy approached me probably about 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, Arvely said, let's go up above the lodge. There's a better place up there. And, of course, with Sam's help, I was able to put more of it together, what we had happened. I thought that we was above the trap farm, but when we got to the trap farm, I realized that the trap farm is above the lodge.
Okay.
But I knew White's Lodge was there, mm-hmm. and we was above it. But then we finally put it together to what had happened. He had taken me to the trap farm and brought me back down and across from White's Lodge and got him a cup of coffee. Then we'd be seated around the next curve, and that's when we parked and got out and started fishing.
Okay.
And at that point, one of them said, Charlie, there's your buddy. And I looked around from behind the truck, and sure enough, that same car.
Same car, same guy?
Yeah.
I mean, you could.
Well, I don't know if it's the same guy or not, but,
yeah.
You know, it's the same car.
Yeah.
And he went around the curves to the right, and they said, what are you going to do? And I pointed my pole up the stream there, so I'm going right there to fish. And I proceeded around the truck and started through there, and then one of them hollered and said, Charlie, there he is. And I have this bad habit that I look down a lot when I'm walking.
Okay.
That's when I'm thinking.
Is that a bad habit?
I
just probably know where you're going.
But when I'm thinking,
you know,
if I'm looking at things, it takes me off from what I'm trying. I'm really trying to concentrate on what do you think this guy might do later on? Is he up the road? Do I need to keep an eye out for him? And finally, one of them said, Charlie, there he is. And I looked back at them to see which way their eyeballs were directed. And so I looked up the road in front of him, and there he was off in his cove. And I'm thinking, well, he's right up there about where I'm going to fish, too. Then I look back again. They said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm pointing my pole at the rocks. I'm going right there to fish. And I guess that was the arrogance in me. I started up the road and got to almost where I was going. Some little boys were throwing some rocks in the water there. Or at least I thought that's what they were doing. And I was going to go above them, which is going to put me right at him to come above them to fish.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, my left leg went out from under me. It was sort of a weird step that I was making, you know. I wasn't able to keep my balance. I slammed the road so hard that a can of corn was squashed in my left hand and my fishing pole in my right hand.
Did you hear a shot or anything?
My subconscious picked up the shot.
Yeah.
I didn't know I was shot.
Yeah.
I had no idea what had just hit my leg.
And he's behind you at that point. Is that right?
He's in front of me.
He's in front of you. Okay.
Right.
All right.
Yeah. And as I pushed myself back up off the road, you know, and looked at almost getting knuckles and things, I immediately went to my leg. That's where my brain was thinking, you know, what's going on down here? And it was like a mad hornet on steroids.
Yeah, in Sam's piece, you said that it felt like a serious hornet sting.
Yeah, I was trying to find something out of it that maybe someone could identify the pain that I was in at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the pain kept growing.
Yeah.
And it's like it kept going deeper and deeper into my leg as seconds went by. And then someone hollered and said, Charlie, did he just shoot at you? And at that time, my subconscious had heard the pow, and I started to put it all together, and I thought, did he shoot me? And I looked up in his direction, and at that point, he was aiming at me again, and he squares off another round.
And he had a pistol.
He had a pistol. So I saw the arm recoil back. I heard the pow, and I gritted my teeth, waiting for that bullet to hit me.
Whew.
And I tell people that it was sometime later in the hospital when I put it together that in TV we see people get shot, you know, and that's the way it goes. The arm goes back, you hear the pow, and then the bullet hits the guy.
Right.
But in real life, it's the opposite way. You're hit.
And then you hear.
Then you hear the pow.
Yeah, right.
So when he shot, I actually saw the recoil of his arm, then I heard the pow. And I gritted my teeth for the bullet to hit me, not knowing the bullet's long gone.
Yeah.
It's already past me. And then he turned and squares off what I can't remember. It's whether it's one shot or two shots over his head. I saw him when he tucked the gun, aimed it over his head.
Held it over his head.
And went up the hill.
Okay.
I don't know if that was just
bang, bang up into the air.
Yeah, okay. Just a warning shot for somebody else not to come after him or whatever. I don't know what was on his mind there.
When you saw him standing in front of you holding the gun, pointing it at you, how far away was he?
Oh, it's almost 50, 75 yards.
Okay, okay.
I guess that.
Yeah, about.
It's long. You'd have to be there to see the distance, and then you would say yourself, sure. My goodness. And someone say he was lucky. He could have been lucky, but the word of the people there in town and the sheriff's office was that this fellow was an excellent shot. He'd win all the turkey shoots, all the little things that they had involving pistols, rifles, or whatever, that he was always winning most of those things. He was that good a shot. So,
well, and he got you once.
Yeah.
He did get you once. How many shots then total? About three or four?
Yeah, three or four, but only two directed at me.
One hit, and the second one missed.
And then the other ones were just shots up over his head. I saw the gun up over his head,
okay. So
I knew he wasn't shooting at me. But meantime, I guess a scary moment was that there was two little young boys down underneath the bank that heard when I got shot. They come up on the bank at that time. And then when he shot at me the second time, I remember telling them to, you know, stay down, get down, because I was afraid they was going to get shot.
Yeah.
And then when he went up the hill like that, they poked up again, and I said, you can go now, you can go now, and they went off down the road. And at that point, I realized that I couldn't move. I'm just like I was locked up from the hip down.
Mm-hmm.
So I fell back to the ground and crawled over to the bank, trying to get away out of the way of this guy's vision to shoot me.
Mm-hmm.
He would have to do some climbing and coming down the bank, and I'm figuring that maybe I can hear the leaves or the twigs breaking, whatever, to keep up where he's at. But I was just trying to make myself difficult. I wanted to go the other way, but
I took
a chance on going, falling into the water and couldn't get out.
Well, you had that presence of mind. I mean, on a certain level, I mean, fortunately, I guess for myself, I've never been shot. I haven't been through that experience. But to have that kind of presence of mind to think those sorts of things through.
I got a stubborn button, but at that point, the fear factor hit in.
So it's
time now. There's no time to be brave now. You know, you got to get out of cover, under the cover somewhere.
Well, tell you what, we're going to continue your story in just a second. And Sam, I want to bring you into this conversation to talk about a guy named Fred Ellis. So we're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Today, Charlie Molden is here with his remarkable story of racial hatred, healing, forgiveness. Also here in the studio, Sam Venable, the Knoxville News Sentinel columnist who introduced us to Charlie Molden and his story in a special series earlier this year. If you have questions or comments, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell. 46 years ago, Charlie Molden was shot while fishing in Monroe County because he's black. There were witnesses, a slam dunk case, but the man holding the gun never spent a day in prison for shooting Molden. Earlier this year, Knoxville News Sentinel columnist Sam Venable unearthed this extraordinary story. Both Molden and Venable are here with me in the studio today waiting for your questions. You can catch us on Twitter, on Facebook, or by calling us at 974-5050, 974-5050. And Sam, I want to turn to you just for a second. And if you could, please tell me a little bit about this guy, Fred Ellis. What do we know about Fred Ellis?
As Charles and I have spoken before, I never met the man. Charles met him twice in one day, but I have done quite a bit of research on him. And I guess you have to understand the culture of the time. This was a mountain family that had always lived back in the Coker Creek area and pretty much had their own run of the place. Apparently did a lot of whiskey making and poaching and is a pretty violent family. I mean, Fred did not die of a violent death himself. He died of cancer, which I think was exacerbated by his drinking.
Mm-hmm.
But he had two brothers who were killed in shootouts or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And just a pretty violent time. I rather liken it to the situation down in Roan County right now, but it's a different era.
I mean,
there's more... Mm-hmm. More information about it and all this, and I think that they had pretty much just lived as they wanted to live.
Incidentally, for those listening, when you say Roane County, you're talking about the Houstons.
Yeah. And when I started digging into the stuff about Fred Ellis, I found just a litany of arrests down there during the era for public drunkenness, for having untaxed whiskey and all that. Quite sadly, ironically, 1 year to the day after he was found not guilty of shooting Charles Molden, Fred Ellis was found guilty of possessing untaxed liquor, and I think they fined him $69. And I thought, ain't that interesting that you can shoot somebody and walk away from it, but you better not have untaxed whiskey.
And even then, he only had a fine of $69. I want to get to the trial, because that's an important part of the story too. But another part of the story, Charlie, is when you were, after you were shot, you had a hard time getting anybody to come out to pick you up.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, let's remind everybody, this is 1968. You didn't have an iPhone on your hip at the time.
No.
And you got to understand, too, the racial tensions that were going on right then, just a few days after Martin Luther King had been assassinated. Mm-hmm. So
there were concerns.
Yeah, right.
But what happened there? You'd moved the truck, or you had moved behind the truck, right, and then moved the truck.
Well, I was several feet in front of the truck, I guess a good 50 yards up the hill from the truck, when I went against the bank, and I finally started hollering and somebody come and help me. And they kept hollering they couldn't come up there because they was afraid he was still up on that hill somewhere with a gun. And I remember I'm having a conversation with supposedly, I believe, a government worker or a game warden or something like that had pulled up. And Arverly was trying to get the gun from him. He kept saying, "I don't have a gun." And he said, "What in the world are you people up here? What in the world are you people doing here without a gun in this area?" And to me, I'm still trying to figure out what kind of area this is. But I just wanted someone to come and help me. And they wouldn't come, so I figured the only way I was going to get any help, because I was in so much pain, was try to go to them. So I actually fell back onto the road and crawled down the road and went into the passenger side of the truck, which is away from the hill.
Yeah.
To where if he was going to shoot at me, you know, I wasn't doing no ducking and dodging, but at least I had the truck between me and him.
Yeah, right.
So I opened up and crawled across the floorboard and mashed the clutch in and let it roll back so far and then let it back out, which was stopped. They were hollering, telling me which way to turn the wheel. And we finally got the truck back around the curve. It seemed like it took an eternity to do it. Mm-hmm. But I done what they told me to do. So they finally came in over across the top of me, cranked the truck up, backed around to where they could back in. I imagine it was in front of White's Lodge. And then the boys at that time climbed into the back. They helped push me up in the truck. And then we proceeded out of the mountain. We found out from the government worker over on his two-way radio that the ambulance people wouldn't come up there to pick me up.
Hmm.
They was that afraid.
They were afraid, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it was just about as dangerous for a white person to help a black person at that time than it was for being black also, if I might mention that.
Yeah. Well, so, and that's important to kind of keep all that in context. And then, Sam, you know, chime in here. As far as the trial itself is concerned, it was a very short trial.
It was, well, actually, the first one was a hung jury. They did have a trial in May.
And this happened in April. That's pretty quick.
It happened, yeah. And but they had that, and it was a hung jury, and then they retried it in September, I believe.
Yeah, it was September.
And the trial lasted just a short amount of time, and the jury was out for less than, I think, a half hour, and they came back and pronounced Fred Ellis not guilty, even though Charles identified him and the other three guys identified him. You might tell them about walking into the courtroom that day, Charlie, and identifying him.
Yeah, so, what was that like?
Yeah, the sheriff met us in Van Oor, right outside of Van Oor.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, the first time down to pick a jury, they took us all down in his cruiser. Mm-hmm. And we parked our truck at some local filling station or something like that. But anyway, the first day there, we walked into this room, and then they said that they have the person that they think is the one responsible for shooting me in the courtroom. but he's out in the audience with other people. And we want you, one at a time, to go into the courtroom, see if you can identify that person, walk back into this room, the sheriff's office or whatever room it was, and give some type of identification.
Sort of like a lineup, except for...
Yeah, but there were several people out there. Yeah. And as soon as I walked in, scanned the room, I immediately saw him.
Yeah.
And then went back and told him, you know, what he looked like, you know, a little flowery shirt, a little Hawaiian-type shirt he had on. Each one didn't get a chance to hear what the other one was saying.
Yeah.
And we all four identified the same person.
Was it? I mean, was there any doubt when you saw him? I mean, you said no, the guy.
I seen the cold-blooded eyes right then. You know, it's just
when you identified him. And this might seem kind of a minor thing, but when you identified him, did you identify him from the moment you saw him when he first talked to you and told you to get out of town, basically, or from when he had the gun leveled at you?
Both times.
Yeah,
because whenever I saw him the first time, I had a real good look at him because I was looking dead in his eyes. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I was trying to make my mind whether I want to just let him go ahead and say what he wants to say or what I want to punch him. And so I got a real good look at him. You know? And when he shot me, got a real good look, even though he was a longer distance.
Yeah.
Because the lawyer kept saying how in the world could I identify a person like that. And I said, hey, let him put a gun in his hand, aim it at you. You'll identify it.
It leaves sort of a marker in your mind there. Yeah.
So it surprised me that they done what they done. But I have to know that Sam probably knows more about the case than I do, because in the very beginning, I wasn't allowed in the courtroom.
You weren't allowed in the courtroom?
No. I was out in the lobby.
Did you want to go in the courtroom?
Yeah, I wanted to know what was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
But they said that I couldn't be in there until after I testified.
When he...
So all the other people that they was testifying on his behalf for the prosecution, which went first.
Okay.
I never got a chance to hear none of them.
Would you, when you pointed him out in the courtroom, did you, was he looking at you? I mean, was there eye contact there?
Oh, yeah, cold, still eyes, you know, You know, and I was looking at him, you know, he realized, you know, that I didn't like him either. But I didn't say anything to him. I didn't make no motions or anything. When I saw him, I just turned around and went back out and went to this room and told him that he's the third row back, starting from the inside on the right-hand side, about the third person in.
So Sam, you went through, you've done a lot of investigation for this piece, and you listened to a lot of the court recordings, which I think are remarkable. I was going to actually, for this program, try to play some of them on the air. They're still, they'd be probably difficult to listen to.
Very difficult.
But let me just throw this out there. We have a link to Sam's series on our webpage at WUOT.org. And if you go there, you can actually listen to some of the court recordings. Right. They're fascinating.
Well, there were two parts of this story that just made the story. One was finding that Charles Molden was still alive.
Yeah.
I started looking into it. I thought he was long dead like everybody else involved in the case. The other was I was down there when the court clerk looked up all the records and everything and told me, yes, I've got him, come down and take a look. She said, I'm really sorry. She apologized for the condition. This was paper. All those records had been water damaged years earlier. They were water damaged. They were bug eaten. And it was just like onion skin paper trying to tear them apart. And I asked then, I said, well, what about the actual testimony? And they said, you know, it was recorded on these old acetate discs and they're just gone. And said, we found some before of different cases. And when you pick them up, they just fall apart. So I thought, well, shoot, I'd sure like to have that. Not too long before we put the entire thing together, the court clerk called me, and she said, I got down there in the basement and started digging around. She said, I found these things. They're like a 45 record.
Okay.
But she said, we have no equipment to play them on. Everything was antiquated and gone. And I chased around for 2 or 3 days at different courthouses and talking to different people involved in recordings and everything, and finally found somebody that could put them on a turntable, slow them down or speed them up as necessary. That equipment was so primitive that the speed with which it was recorded was kind of up to the discretion of the court clerk.
Oh,
some
sure.
of them would be like 22 RPM, then it'd slow to 16, then it might go up to 27 and that. And the person that we found was able to to get it slowed and, you know, and move it and transcribe. And it's still pretty scratchy, but yet you could actually hear the testimony at the time. And that was just, I sat there and listened to every bit of it, and it just make chills go up and down your back. You could hear the buses going by and the trucks in, out in the road.
Let me ask you this, because you know how this case turned out. You know that Fred Ellis was acquitted mm-hmm. in, what would you say, half an hour yeah. jury deliberation, yeah. mm-hmm. all white, all male mm-hmm. jury from yeah. Monroe County, right. that area. When you listen to the these court recordings, does it, if you didn't know how this turned out, would you have come to the conclusion that, wow, this guy's toast?
Again, I guess you can only listen to it thinking of it in the context
yeah.
of the times.
Yeah.
And the defense lawyer, you know, he did his job. He's trying to plant doubt in the jury's mind. Well, how could you – wasn't it foggy that morning? Now, how could you possibly identify it? I think Charles and the others testified that there was some green on this car, a green fender or something like that. And then they had testimony that, no, it was an all-black car, a 52 Chevy or something. I can't remember exactly.
So get your story straight.
Yeah, that yeah. type of thing. And over, well, how can you tell me that wasn't there vegetation coming out? You know, just – planting the seeds of doubt in a very fertile soil that they
sure.
didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to. I mean, this is one of theirs, you know, one of the local guys. And
yeah.
even though he may have been what we call in the times a police character, you know, in and out of jail all the time,
mm-hmm.
He's local. And these guys are all the way from Sevier County. They ain't from around here, that type of thing.
Yeah.
So I thought the DA in his closing arguments, and that matter of fact, that's on that link that
mm-hmm.
you have.
Yeah.
He was very impassioned, and again, using the language of the era and the prevailing attitudes of the era. I think I may be putting words in his mouth. The exact stuff is available
sure.
to listen to. But he says something about his closing arguments. He says this, you know, he said something about he may, and again, using the language of the era, he said he may have just shot a negra this time, but the next time it might not be a negra. You know, it's kind of like, even though he's pushing the case, he's saying, yeah, it might not be one of these guys, and it might be one of us next time.
Yeah, yeah.
But even with that, it was just still, boom, not guilty. And I do think, I listened to the prosecution, and I think the DA did his best to bring about a guilty verdict. I think the sheriff.
But he was fighting an uphill battle.
Oh, yeah. It was just to kill a mockingbird sort of stuff, you know.
Charlie, do you remember how you felt when you heard were you in the courtroom when you heard the verdict?
Yes.
Yeah.
What? The hung jury.
The hung jury.
But not the acquittal?
No.
Why not?
Both times that I was told, the first time that hung jury, the second time it was a hung jury. Okay. Somewhere along the line, they changed the verdict on that second trial.
Well, I don't think they yeah. changed it. I think you may have had it in your mm-hmm. head that, I mean, the court mm-hmm. record is the court record, you
right.
know. But I can understand where, mm-hmm. I think, didn't the prosecutor say we needed to come back and keep pushing this thing?
Yeah.
And that's when you said.
That you said, I got to move on.
Yeah. Well, I sort of got an idea of what the public thought of me after meeting this old lady in the lobby.
Yeah, tell me that story, because I was just telling somebody else that story here.
I'm a friendly person, and mm-hmm. I'll speak. And through speaking, I can find out whether you want to be friends with me or not be friends
mm-hmm.
with
sure.
me. And I've had a lot of people who won't even respond to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, we'll go on. But anyway, this lady was there, and a little short, frail lady, and I said, hello, how are you? And he looked at her, and she said, he should have killed you. We don't like your kind down here, no, hand.
Wow.
You know, by kind, she referred to me as the N-word, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow. You know, this is just out in the lobby. I can imagine what the people on the jury are thinking. This is a woman. You know, I can understand the man, because that's the way I grew up in, thinking that way. But you wouldn't have
expected that from a little old lady.
Not that many women. Most of the time, if they're by themselves, they'll speak their mind. Usually, if they're with their man, they'll say what the man wants them mm-hmm. to say. But when they're by themselves, you know, usually you get a different response. So when she said that, I thought, wow, you know, you ain't got a chance. So there was no need that I was going to go back the third time and waste those guys. You know, they poured concrete for a living, and they was missing a day's work each time we had to go down to pick the jury and go down for the trial and whatever. So that was just too many days of work missed. Yeah. And, you know, we were all working class family, so they're going to turn him loose. So why are we wasting our time?
Just make sure you don't go fishing in Monroe County.
So I told him, I said, I'm going to do all of them a favor then. They like him that well, I'm going to leave him with him. That's because I can live the rest of my life and never come back here.
We're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Today, Charlie Molden is here. You've been listening to his remarkable story. And also, Sam Venable is with us, the Knoxville News Sentinel columnist who introduced us to Charlie Molden and his story in a special series earlier this year. If you have questions or comments, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell. 46 years ago, Charlie Molden was shot while fishing in Monroe County because of the color of his skin. Charlie is black. There were witnesses. Should have been a slam dunk case, but the man holding the gun never spent a day in prison for shooting him. Earlier this year, Knoxville News Sentinel columnist Sam Venable unearthed this extraordinary story, and both Molden and Venable are here with me in the studio today waiting for your questions. You can catch us on Twitter, on Facebook, or by calling us at 974-5050, 974-5050. And during the break, we were talking about how today is actually the 50th anniversary of the implementation of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and how it's interesting to think of the fact that Charlie was shot 4 full years after that. So it's not as if the country just
didn't change,
hit a wall and just turned like, you know, those little cars that bounce off.
Sure. And it's evolving even today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go to Andy. Andy's calling from Knoxville and has a question, I believe a question for you, Sam. Andy, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Mr. Venable, I was interested in how you found out about this story and what made you start investigating it.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great question. I had heard this story off and on rumored for years. I was the outdoors editor of the News Sentinel starting in 1970, which was, just after that case. But I'd heard bits and pieces of it all along, and I started just a year or two ago, making some preliminary calls into the area, and I would get so far, people said, oh, yeah, I remember the case. Oh, yeah, Fred Ellis shot that guy and all that. And when I'd start, the more I would quiz, the more the amnesia would suddenly take over, and they'd realize they didn't want to stir anything up. Hmm. And finally, it dawned on me this year. I thought, go to the doggone courthouse. The records are there. And start looking. I was convinced that everybody involved in it was dead. I mean, it was a 46-year-old case. And I was down there actually just going to be doing essentially this is what happened in 1968 story. Mm-hmm. And one of the people in the courthouse said, you know, we went over the list of jurors and everything. He said, this guy's dead, this guy's dead, this guy's dead, this guy's dead. And he said, I have heard that this Molden fella is still alive. And I said, you're kidding. And he said, No, I heard that. He said he worked in concrete. I can remember that. He was a bricklayer, a concrete finisher or something. And I came back and started, you know, getting on the internet and, you know, cross-referencing and all this. And 2 or 3 days later, you know, I kept leaving numbers wherever I could. Mm-hmm. 2 or 3 days later, I come in and there's my lights blinking at the office, and I pick it up, and it says, this is Charles Molden. I understand you're trying to reach me. I bet fell out of my chair. And I remember my editor was walking down the hall, and I was hollering at him and waving, and I said, I've got him. I've got him on the phone right now. And the next day, we were in Cherokee. He's looking, you know, piecing it back together.
Charlie, what was your reaction when you got that message from Sam?
Well, my sisters called me early one morning when I was doing a job in Columbia, Tennessee, mm-hmm. with the company I worked for. And they said, there's a Sam Venable of the Knoxville News Sentinel is trying to get a hold of you. He left this number for you to call him. I said, what does he want? Is there something about, Cherokee National Forest or something other? I said, it must have been someone else. Cause I didn't know that Teleco was in Cherokee National Forest until I asked Sam.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I had the number, and I waited probably, what, 10 o'clock?
Yeah, something like that.
I wasn't calling at first. I didn't have no idea what it was all about.
So you didn't know it had anything to do with the shooting?
No.
Yeah.
In a way, but I didn't know what he wanted. It was so negative back then. I didn't know if it's something other is going to carry over into another negative episode or something other. Yeah. So I was a little leery. So.
Sure.
But at the same time, I'd read a lot of his articles over the years, and I've come to love Sam, his article.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never met Sam the man,
but
I knew Sam's articles, and it was all good. I'd buy the Sunday paper just to read his article. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't read nothing else in it. So finally, I got enough nerve to call him, and of course, I didn't get a hold to him. Got his voicemail, and I just told him, "It's Charles Mullen. I believe you're trying to get a hold to me."
How about that?
So I left him my cell phone number where he could call me directly. And so it wasn't just shortly after that he called.
Well, the great question, Andy. Thanks so much for the question. Let's go to Jim. Jim is calling from Knoxville as well. Jim, welcome to Dialogue.
Hello.
Yeah.
This is Jim Brown. I've just had a comment for Sam and for Charles that I'm so happy and proud that they brought all this to our attention. I think we've come a long way, but we've got a lot of healing and a lot of growth to do in this area. And thank you both for stepping forward and calling this case to our attention. And
thank you. I've always said ever since this started, thanks, Charles, for staying alive.
Of course, that was only part one of it.
Yeah.
He had to call you back, too.
Yeah, that's true.
No. Yeah. Thank you very much. A great call from Jim. And I wonder, Charlie, how did this affect you back then? I mean, as you mentioned, you were living in a predominantly white area where not many people were African American. Did it make you angry or bitter? Did you find yourself looking at your white friends differently?
I was very angry. I should have stayed in my house most of the time, and of course I couldn't go to work or anything. I had friends that wanted to come by and talk to me, and I was in the back bedroom, wouldn't even come out. And then finally I had one friend that I played softball with actually walked past my wife and walked to the back bedroom with tears in his eyes and just said, "Please don't shut me and my brother out of your life. We grew up together. We've actually got in our trucks and cars and went looking for the Ku Klux Klans when you was going to school here for messing with you," and said, "Just don't shut us out," you know, with tears in his eyes. Mm-hmm. And he still had to leave without any apologies from me on that part. And I remember my wife looked at me and said, "You know, it takes a big man with tears in his eyes to come to you like that." Said, "There wasn't one that shot you, Charles. This guy, Fred C. Ellis, was the one that shot you." I said, "Okay." I was a little arrogant back then. I won't repeat none of the words I said at that time. Keep in mind, my dad was a sailor, so we know some good words. So anyway, I let it go. And then the next day, you know, I've got a conscience that really bothers me pretty bad when I know I'm doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. So I got my crutches, went off the porch, went down the street to this boy's house and walked up his front door. Got his attention inside. And of course, they wanted me to come inside, and I apologized to him for acting the way I was. And so my healing process started right then.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to talk to your God for a long time. You know, everybody wants to know where is he at the time this is happening. But at the same time, you got to realize that sometimes you get your own self into a mess. But he's there to protect you. So I got myself in the mess. He protected me. I didn't die. Mm-hmm. And I lived, you know. So maybe he had something in store for me later on. But I've got a tremendous lot of white friends. I made a new friend with Sam. This was just more than just telling a story. He's just a genuine good person. I've got a lot of respect for him because there's not many white men that will step forward to tell a story like that for a black person. I'm not worth a whole lot of money. I'm not a movie star or nothing like that. I'm just no common working guy. And he allowed me to tell my story. And he didn't change any of it. He told it exactly like it happened. And my hat's off to him. And And my heart bleeds for him because he is a good friend. He's a good man to begin with, and he's become a friend of mine now.
I've got to tell one story that, excuse me, that I guess we've got the time. Pardon me. Me and my allergy, we were putting this all together, and Charles brings his yearbook over to my house.
That's and, right. I was actually going to ask you about this.
And we're starting to put stuff together. And he says, and he shows me this picture of them carrying their coach off the football field. And he said, and there's Charles right there in the thick of them carrying the coach. And he said, that we upset Young High School that night. And he points to a picture, and he says, you can see this Young High player off to the side looking very dejected. He said, that's Young, I believe. I said, you better believe it, Young. I said, that's Dickie Black. I said, stay right here. I rang up my yearbook, came back down, flipped over to the football team. I said, see that? What was it, 71, Charles? I think it was his number. I said, look, see, yeah, right 71. There, that's Dickie Black. And I said, look back here. I said, that little runt back there is me. I said, Charles, you and I are at the same game, for heaven's sakes.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Both of us dressed out. I will put it there. We both participated in that game. And
One of you ended the game with a dirty uniform,
yes,
and one of you didn't.
One of them ended the game with splinters in his rear end, as he always did. But, yeah, I thought that was just fabulous that on that night – you know, that was in, what, 63, I guess, Charlie?
63.
August or September of 63. We are right there, football field apart, and don't meet until 2014.
And now you've gone back out. You've gone trout fishing in that same spot. Yeah. What was that like? Tell me about that.
Well, Sam took me back, and it was better this time because I knew the guy that shot me was dead.
Well, and you didn't get shot a second time either. Right. So the bar was set pretty low.
You got to tell him what you did on your first catch. So this is what amazing.
Sam gave me his favorite fishing spot. He said, this is a good spot. I always catch fish here. I'm going to let you fish that spot there, and I'm going to go right on up here. And my first cast, I caught a fish.
Just like that.
Yeah, probably right the nicest the one I caught for the day.
Trout might have been waiting for you for 46 years. waiting for you to come back.
But we eventually went to the hole where I was heading to go fish, and he allowed me to go fishing there. And I really had to fish it really hard, and I finally caught me something upwards of a large minnow. But I caught me a fish out of that hole, so...
How much time have you spent thinking about this whole incident over the years? Now, obviously, since Sam approached you, you probably spent a lot of time thinking about it. But before that?
Before that, not much. Because I realized where this hatred come from. And just people just carry stuff in their heart for year after year after year, and then they explode. Maybe it's the reason why you see so much violence now. I realized that it was getting me down. I imagined to myself one day that good Lord had called me above and gave me one wish, and my wish was that I'd like to be sitting at the 50-yard line and listen to you ask one question when people come before you, why was you so prejudiced while you was on earth? And listen to them give him the answer that I've heard before. And I'd watch him and the son, Jesus Christ, both fall out of their chair on the ground laughing. Yeah, wouldn't be able to say nothing. They'd crack up at some answers because some of them are funny. Like one in particular, the Ku Klux Klansman holding the Bible in his hand, you know, looking at me and me grinning in his face. And he looked at me and he said, I'm going to tell you something, mother. He said, you do know that you people were put here on earth for us to abuse, don't you? And I said, no, I didn't know that. And it's right there in your Bible. See, that's why I missed that page. Then again, I can't read and write that well.
I was going to ask if you could play that card again in that situation. Now, you told Sam that you would forgive the man who shot you if you had the opportunity. As Sam mentioned, he's been dead for a long time. Mm-hmm. Are there moments when you're not so sure, or are you very confident that if he was standing in front of you that you would say, I forgive you?
Now, I would. At that time, for the first several years there, if you've been standing in front of me, I used to tell people, you know, that I plant in like a daisy. I mean, mm-hmm. Someone said, "But you need to come back to court and do this over again so you can make things right." I said, "If we want to make this right." And I said, "Put us both into a room and give me a gun." And I said, and let me shoot him in the leg and let him go through the pain that I went through. Not only, you know, it's a career-changing moment for me. I had a wife and a child at the time that I wasn't able to care for because I couldn't go to work. It got pretty rough. I remember when I went to work, I had to, with the same orderly partner, gave me a job to let me do what I could do. And I took and strapped the board to my bullet leg and actually crawled along the edge of the concrete slab and finished the edges of it.
Wow. With this board strapped to your leg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For $20 a day.
So you don't feel the same way now that if given the opportunity where you could hold the gun, you...
No.
No.
No. It's something that's about taking a life. That's not what my job was here on this earth. Nowhere alone. Kevin.
Well, we are unfortunately out of time here on Dialogue. Thank you so much to our guest, Charlie Molden, and our good pal, Sam Venable, for joining us today. If you're interested in reading Sam's series called Fragments of Hate, an excellent piece, you can find it, link to it on our webpage at WUOT.org. Thanks also to Greg Hill, who ran the board and handled the phones today. Matt Moon monitored our social media. And thanks to you for listening and calling and sending your questions. If you missed the show or you just want to hear it again, we should have it up on our webpage in the next hour or so. Once again, the web address is WUOT.org. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville, WUOT HD1 Knoxville, and WUOT.org, a listener-supported service of the University of Tennessee.